Two schools, both employing methods of interpretation, Shammai and Hillel, emerge and debate with one another until, according to tradition, it is declared, both sides are the words of the living God, but the law is in accordance with the house of Hillel. Today's lecture is, in a certain sense, the opposite of yesterday's. Our previous discussion utilized the methodology of interpretation that we are attempting to pioneer for Avot in interpreting the entire first chapter as a description of Jewish history. Today we will focus largely on one individual in Avot and mostly on only a few lines of rhetoric from this one individual. If, as we have argued, a tractate Avot is simultaneously celebrated and misunderstood, then of all the rabbis in Avot, the most celebrated, but also the most misunderstood, is Hillel. And it is his most famous virtue, presented as his foremost maxim in Avot, that has led to this misinterpretation. Hillel v'Shammai kiblu mehem. This is Mishnah 12 in your version of the first chapter. Hillel Omer, Hillel would say, Hevei mitalmidav shel Aharon, ohev shalom v'rodev shalom, ohev et abriot mekorvan la'Torah. Be among the students of Aaron, the high priest, a lover of peace and a pursuer of peace, lover of all men, and bringing them close to the Torah. This is Hillel's personality. Hillel is a peaceful person. And his maxim highlights the potential of peacefulness to draw individuals to the Torah. Thus, one of the most cited Talmudic tales about Hillel, indeed one of the most cited Talmudic tales of all time, describes a Gentile approaching Hillel's colleague, Shammai, and the Gentile asserts that he is willing to convert to Judaism if the rabbi can summarize the entire Torah while he, the Gentile, stands on one foot. This, of course, is chutzpah. And Shammai chases the impertinent inquirer away with a rod. The Gentile then approaches Hillel, lover of peace, who agrees to this condition, and as this prospective convert stands on one foot, Hillel succinctly states, "Madasani lach lo tavid l'chavre, what is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow." This, he says, is the entire Torah, v'idach pirusha zil gmor. The rest is its commentary. Go and learn it. This is Hillel, humble man of peace, slow to anger. Today, however, because of this story, poor Hillel is portrayed as some sort of non-judgmental postmodern pluralist. Thus, I was once at a gathering of various Jewish leaders and public intellectuals in Aspen, where I commented that what Judaism needs is its own C.S. Lewis, who would make the case persuasively and eloquently for Jewish doctrine and dogma, and another participant in the conference, an editor and writer of some prominence, responded that this was impossible because there is no authoritative doctrine in Judaism to be discovered and defended. And in support for this remarkable contention, the intellectual cited the tale of Hillel and the convert, meaning he was drawing on the story in arguing that the entire Torah is nothing but love your neighbor and all else is personal commentary. There is no Jewish dogma that can be acknowledged or discovered. And I responded by noting that in the very same Talmudic passage, Hillel is also approached by another potential convert who wishes to convert on condition that Hillel will teach him the written Torah, but not the oral law. Hillel here again agrees, and on the first day teaches the convert the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, Bet, Gimel. The next day, Hillel reverses the identification and informs the convert that Gimel is Aleph and Aleph is Gimel. The convert is astonished. And he says, yesterday, you told me the exact opposite. And Hillel says, aha, that's precisely my point. If you trust me when it comes to the basics, if you trust me when it comes to learning Hebrew, you must trust me regarding the entire tradition of the oral law. Meaning, you must accept on my authority the entire oral law, otherwise the Torah that you are learning is meaningless. Without this doctrine, without my tradition, without the interpretive authority of the rabbis, Hillel is saying, there is no Judaism. This is also Hillel. It's the same passage, but no one quotes that story. So was Hillel doctrinaire and dogmatic? Of course he was. He was one of the fathers of rabbinic Judaism, not a postmodern cartoon character. And that, of course, is entirely reconcilable with his personality and with his opening maxim: acquire a peaceful personality, embrace individuals, so that they can be brought closer to the Torah. But by the Torah, he means the Torah as Hillel understands it, with all its attendant dogma and doctrines. And this, of course, is what Hillel actually adds to the convert who stands on one foot, the part of the statement that everyone fails to stress. The rest is commentary, zil gmor. Go and learn it. Put the next foot forward. Learn the entire Torah. And by the entire Torah, he means, of course, the Torah as the rabbis understand it. So Hillel, then, is an individual personification of Avot, so beloved, but so misunderstood in the modern age. And if Avot today is seen as entirely about ethics, then Hillel himself is also in Avot, all too often understood to be speaking in a narrowly ethical sense when he is actually addressing larger theological and religious questions. This is certainly true of perhaps his most famous maxim, also advanced in Avot in our chapter: Im ein ani li mi li, uchesha'ani li atzmi ma'ani. If I am not to myself or for myself, who will be for me? And if I am only for myself, who am I? Today, this is almost universally understood as a statement about ethics, about balanced spheres of responsibility. On the one hand, im ein ani li mi li, I need to look out for number one. Got to take care of myself, because who else will take care of me? At the same time, k'shani la'atzmi ma'ani, what am I if I am only about myself? I must also show concern for others. This is famous. This is how Hillel is always cited. And yet, what most people fail to realize is that such a rendering and understanding of Hillel's words was largely unknown until recently. In the medieval period of Jewish interpretation of Avot, there is no unanimity about what exactly Hillel intends to convey here. But there is unanimity in the assumption that Hillel speaks largely about aspects of the spiritual quest or the religious life, not of balancing self-interest and selflessness. Not because that's a bad message. It just was never understood as having anything to do with what Hillel was talking about. You can open up an Avot and look at all the medieval commentaries. Nobody says this. Thus, Rashi interprets Im ein ani li mi li as follows, and I quote, Im ani lo akayem et ha-mitzvot, mi mekayem otam b'shvili. If I don't fulfill the mitzvot on my own, who will fulfill them for me? And the attendant statement, ukshani la'atzmi ma'ani, is read by Rashi as a statement not of ethical obligation, but of humility. Ki af kishani oseh, writes Rashi, eini magia l'chovotai hamutelat alai. Even when I do obey the mitzvot, I will never fully reach the level of fulfillment that is incumbent upon me. That's how Rashi reads it. Maimonides, in a slightly Aristotelian twist on this, understands the statement to be related to the development of the soul. Im ein ani li mi li, comments Maimonides, if I myself will not be the one that arouses my soul's virtue, who will arouse me, as I have no one to stimulate me externally? And when Hillel says, if I am for myself, what am I? From Maimonides, it is, like Rashi's view, rightly understood as a statement of humility. Maimonides writes, quote, it is as if Hillel is questioning himself and saying, what am I? This is to say, what is becoming of me? I am not complete, even if I did this one matter. Rabbeinu Yonah of Gerandi, Sephardic sage, relates Hillel's statement to repentance. If I do not bring myself to improve, who will do it for me? But even when I repent on my own, how worthy can I actually be? In sum, Hillel's most famous maxim has a multitude of medieval interpretations, but none have understood it in the way that it is commonly quoted today. And the modern approach, the de-spiritualization of Hillel's words, parallels the larger trend of secularizing and ethicizing Avot. Today, we will be offering an interpretation of Hillel's statement that understands it also as communicating something other than a purely ethical message, but we will be employing our methodology in interpreting the maxim. Recall our assumption in approaching Avot. These maxims, these sayings, we are assuming, are not unrelated to their originators. They ought to be seen as tips of biographical and intellectual icebergs, revealing something larger about the life story and worldview of the sage uttering this maxim. And thus the case that I am making is that in interpreting these statements, one must look first and foremost to what we know about the biography of the individual that is stating a particular maxim. At the same time, we have to recognize the difficulty in doing this, because we do not have autobiographies from Hillel or any of the other individuals in Avot. There is no genre of memoir in rabbinic history, though think how amazing that would be. Take Rabbi Akiva, ignorant until the age of 40, falls in love with a wealthy woman who gives up her wealth for him, inspires him to go become a Torah sage. Nowadays, Rabbi Akiva would write a self-help book describing his experience. He would go on Oprah. Oprah would tell all her audience that everyone has a free Talmud for them under their chair, and it would be very exciting. But the truth is, the religious traditions of other faiths have extraordinary examples of spiritual memoirs. We have no such thing. Thus, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein famously commented, "An account of Rabbi Akiva's spiritual odyssey could no doubt eclipse Augustine's, but his," meaning Rabbi Akiva's, "confessions have been discreetly muted. The rigors of John Stuart Mill's education are not without parallel in our history, but what corresponds to his fascinating autobiography, or to the passionate apologia pro vita sua of his contemporary John Henry Cardinal Newman," concludes Rav Lichtenstein, "our Johnsons have no Boswells. Our Johnsons have no Boswells." This is true. At the same time, if the first chapter of Avot, as we have argued, describes the development of rabbinic leadership, then we have to look to what does exist in the Talmud about the life stories of these leaders. And the Talmud actually provides us with the most important moment in Hillel's career, the story of Hillel's rise to power. This story has two versions, one in the Jerusalem Talmud and the other in the Babylonian Talmud. And there are interesting differences which have been explicated in a profound way by Rabbi Bini Lau, but many of the details are the same, which seem to indicate that this is no mere legend, but is to some extent an historical account of how Hillel went from largely anonymous Torah student to one of the most important rabbinic leaders in Jewish history. We will be using the Babylonian version. Once we study this tale, we will, I believe, gain new insight, not only into this most famous saying of Hillel. The story will also serve as an understanding of how Hillel became an intellectual linchpin in Jewish history and in the development of Jewish law, the development that the first chapter of Avot describes. Let us set the stage. Avot informed us that Hillel and Shammai were the successors of the previous set of Zugot, Shemaiah and Avtalion. The Talmud in Pesachim, Tractate Pesachim, however, reveals that there was a small period of interim leadership where Pharisaic Judaism was led by the mysterious and apparently ineffectual individuals known as the sons of Beterah. Suddenly, a question arises, a halakha question, to which no obvious answer existed. The 14th of Nisan, the day when the Paschal Lamb was offered, fell on a Saturday. And the question was whether the Paschal sacrifice could be offered by all of Israel on that day. We must imagine this moment. Jews from all over the known world have assembled in Jerusalem, all to observe the Passover, all to slaughter the sacrifice that is the centerpiece of the Seder. And all of a sudden, the religious leadership announces, on the Friday preceding the 14th, we will call it Friday the 13th of Nisan, they announce that suddenly that they have no idea whether the sacrifice can be offered at all. Here is the Talmudic text, and I'll be quoting in part in Aramaic and part from largely the Sefaria translation. Tanu Rabbanan halachazo nita'alma b'bnei Beterah. This law was forgotten by the sons of Beterah. Pamachat chal arba asar liyot b'shabbat. The 14th of Nisan once occurred on Shabbat. And they forgot, velo yadu, im pesach tochet ha-shabbat, im lav. They did not know if the slaughtering of the Paschal Lamb overrode Shabbat or not. Amru lahem, so they said to the populace, klum yesh adam shiyodei im pesach tochet ha-shabbat im lav. Does anyone know whether Pesach can be burned on Shabbat, which is kind of an amazing thing? Amru lahem, populace responded, Adam echad yesh, sha'ala mi-bavel v'hilel ha-bavli shemo. There is one man who came up from Babylonia. He is called Hillel the Babylonian. Sheshimesh shnei gdolei ador shmaya v'avtalion v'yodea im Pesach tochet ha-shabbat. There is one man who actually served, that means studied with, Shmaya and Avtalion. He is from Babylonia, and his name is Hillel the Babylonian, and he surely knows whether we can bring the Paschal Lamb on Shabbat. So, let us pause for a moment and analyze the story thus far. The sons of Beterah face a conundrum. They seek a solution. They are informed of a man by the name of Hillel the Babylonian who came from Babylonia. The repetition here, he's from Babylonia, and his name is the Babylonian, signifies, you know, you read it, you're like, how did he get such an unusual nickname? Signifies that Hillel is an outsider amongst the rabbinic elite. He's not from there. He's not from the land of Israel. He's come up from Babylonia. Interestingly, of all the individuals listed in Avot, Hillel is the only significant sage in the tractate who gives us maxims that are in Aramaic. Thus, in our first chapter, Huaya Omer, Nigid Shema Bad Shemei Udala Mosif Yusuf Udala Yalef Ketal Achayav Udishtamesh Patzaga Chalaf. A name made great is a name destroyed. He who does not increase his knowledge loses it, etc., etc. This is in Aramaic. And then, of course, in the second chapter, where we will meet Hillel again, and in the rabbinic version of Hamlet's Alas, Poor Yorick scene, where Hillel sees a skull floating on the surface of the river, Hillel again speaks in Aramaic, saying, because you murdered, you were killed, etc., etc. So the fact that he is recorded in Aramaic, unlike all the other rabbis, except for two mysterious individuals that are linked to Hillel, Ben Bagbag and Ben Hehe, this indicates that Hillel is from a different culture than the rest of the rabbis. And that even in Israel, he is seen as Hillel HaBavli, at least at this moment. That is not going to be his name later. But that's what they're calling him now. Hillel HaBavli, Hillel the Babylonian. This means that for him to emerge as one of the unparalleled leaders in the history of Judaism in the land of Israel, that would require a set of extraordinary circumstances. And that is exactly what is about to unfold. Hillel may have been an outsider, but the sons of Beteira are desperate for information. Can they bring the sacrifice, or can't they? Let us continue the Talmudic tale. Shalchu v'karulo, so they sent him. They sent for him, and they asked him, Klum ata yodea im ha-pesach doche et ha-shabbat im lav? Do you know if the bringing of the Paschal sacrifice overrides the Shabbat? Amar lahem, he responded to them, V'chi pesach echad yesh lanu b'shana sh'doche et ha-shabbat? V'halo harbe yoter mimatayim psachim yesh lanu b'shana sh'dochin et ha-shabbat? Do we have only one Paschal lamb during the year that overrides Shabbat? We have more than 200 Paschal lambs during the year that overrides Shabbat. What does he mean? Hillel here is offering the following halachic argument. Any communal korban, any sacrifice offered on behalf of the entire nation, is brought in the temple even on the Sabbath. Thus, the korban tamid, the daily offering of a lamb brought once in the morning and once in the afternoon, is offered on Shabbat as well. So there are two lambs offered every Shabbat. The additional offering of Shabbat, what's called the korban musaf, which is another two lambs, is also brought on Shabbat because that also is a communal offering. Thus, every Shabbat features the offering of four lambs as communal offerings in the temple. With over 50 Shabbatot a year, that makes for over 200 lambs offered. Thus, Hillel is arguing, look, this is a simple question. If there are communal offerings, which are lambs, that are offered every Shabbat, why should the Paschal lamb, which is also a communal offering, not be offered on Shabbat as well? This too should override Shabbat. And it is a clever argument, but it is not at all an obvious one. And we have to understand why. Here, the complexity of the halakhic question and of the case Hillel is making actually links to the literary themes of the story. In general, when it comes to temple offerings, either one animal is brought on behalf of the entire nation, like the daily offering, or an animal is brought by every individual. The former overrides Shabbat, the latter does not. The Paschal lamb is unique. Thousands of sacrifices are brought, but they are brought, each lamb is brought by groups of Jews, chaburot, usually 10 or 20 people per lamb. The sons of Beteira are also aware that communal korbanot override Shabbat, but they are not sure whether the Paschal lamb qualifies as such a communal korban, because it is not one lamb brought in honor of Passover for the entire congregation. Many, many lambs are brought. Here, the complexity of the halakha question and the complexity of the literary layers in this story intertwine. The Paschal lamb does not quite fit as a communal korban or an individual korban. Rather, it reflects the balance or the tension between the individual and the community, the personal and the covenantal. And as we shall see, that tension is the theme in Hillel's larger origin story. Hillel offers his argument that we have just heard, but the sons of Beteira are unconvinced. And so they respond back to him, Amru lo, minayin lecha, meaning, from where do you know this? We have to understand what the sons of Beteira are asking of Hillel. Recall why the Holy Land Jews were willing to seek a halachic solution from Hillel the Babylonian. It was because he served, this is all they know about his qualifications, that he served the two most eminent scholars of the past, Shmaya and Avtalion. They're not asking for his own halachic intuition when they come with this question. When they ask, from where do you know this, they mean, who told you? What rabbi informed you of this fact? You, Hillel, they are saying, are drawing an audacious inference from the daily offering, from the Musaf offering, to the Pesach offering. But this is not at all obvious. If we're to be guided by your halachic opinion, it must be based on more than your intuition. You must have heard this from a previous generation, from Shammai and Avtalion. That's the whole reason why we came to you. So where do you get this from? And this is an attitude, what B'nai B'Teira are reflecting. This is an attitude that is an aspect of Jewish legal culture from that time till today. After all, the oral law is founded on transmission, and we look with great reverence to the past, respecting the authorities who came before, often more than the legal giants that are right in front of our face. Once, when I was a rabbinical student in the Yeshiva University Kollel, someone approached one of the Yeshiva University Rosh Yeshiva, one of the halachic luminaries of our generation, with a question. The rabbi responded with an answer, and the student says, how do you know this? So the rabbi says, well, that's what I think. He says, yeah, but who says this? And the rabbi, frustrated, responds, he says, look, if you want, I'll write it down, and then you could shoot me, and you'll have somebody dead who wrote it. Okay? Now, it is a funny response, but there is an aspect of Jewish intellectual culture that embraces this notion. There is a Jewish reverence for dead people who wrote things down, or in that age, the age of the B'nai B'Teira, a reverence for dead people who transmitted information to others who are still alive. Homer Simpson, once hearing about an American historical figure, famously asked about him, if he's so great, how come he's dead? Rabbinic Judaism, in contrast to Homer Simpson, embraces a notion known as Yiridat HaDorot, the decline of generations. Those who come before are granted a certain reverence. So we may often instinctively want to ask a rabbi, if he's so great, how come he's not dead? And so that is what the B'nai B'Teira want to know. You say, Hillel, that we can offer the Paschal Lamb on Shabbat, just as we can offer the daily sacrifice, morning and afternoon, even on Shabbat. How do you know this comparison is correct? What is your source? Who told you? Was it Shammai and Avtalion or some other deceased authority? But Hillel does not give them testimony of transmission from Shammai and Avtalion. In response, he deploys his intellectual firepower and the exegetical devices of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, various versions of what is known as the Yud Gimel Midot Sha'Torah Nidreshet Bahen, the 13 exegetical principles through which, honestly but still creatively employed, allow new insights to be gleaned from the Torah's texts, not through transmission all the time, but through individual interpretation. First, Hillel gives them what is called a Gzera Shava, a textual linkage. And this he may very well have heard from another because these are usually transmitted. Amar Lahem, he said to them, Ne'amar mo'ado b'pesach ve'ne'amar mo'ado b'tamid. Ma mo'ado amur b'tamid doche et ha-shabbat, af mo'ado amur b'pesach doche et ha-shabbat. Hillel said that the word b'mo'ado, that the sacrifice must be brought in its appointed time, that word appears with regard to the Paschal Lamb, and the same word, in its proper time, appears regarding the daily offering. Just as the obligation to offer the daily offering in its proper time overrides Shabbat, so too, the obligation to offer the Paschal sacrifice in its proper time overrides Shabbat. And then he says, V'od kal v'chomer hu. Not only that, but also there is a kal v'chomer. What is a kal v'chomer? This is an a fortiori. A fortiori is a logical deduction which he is employing on his own. If the daily offering, the neglect of which is not punishable by karet, by excision, overrides Shabbat, then surely the Paschal Lamb, the neglect of which is punishable by karet, should override Shabbat. Meaning, failure to offer the korban tamid, the daily offering, is less bad, punishment-wise, than the failure to bring the Paschal sacrifice. We know that the daily offering overrides Shabbat, so a fortiori, certainly, the Paschal sacrifice should override Shabbat. So here again, Hillel is not telling them, I heard this from Shmaya Naftalion, he's using his own intellectual firepower in employing an inference, an argument. Even though they came to Hillel seeking testimony from Shmaya Naftalion, Hillel presents them with exegetical arguments. And there are those who suggest that Hillel is actually reflecting the Babylonian Jewish culture from which he comes, which placed a premium on creativity above rote repetition. Either way, the assembled who hear him are blown away by his unique brilliance. After Hillel brought these proofs, we are told by the Talmud that they immediately seated him at the head and appointed him Nasi over them. Immediately Hoshivu Barosh Uminu Nasi Alehem. V'haya Doresh Kol Hayom Kulo Bilchot HaPesach. And he spent the rest of that day, again, this is Friday the 13th, he spent the entire day expounding on the laws of Passover. In the course of his teaching, we are told, Hitchil Mekantaran Bidvarim. He began rebuking them with his words. Amar Lahen, he said to them, Mi Garam Lachem She'eleh Mibavel Ve'ayeh Nasi Alechem. What caused that I, Hillel, should come up out of Bavel to be the Nasi, the patriarch over you? Atzlut shahita bachem. It is the laziness that all of you people have. Shaloshi mashtem shnei gdolei ador Shemaya v'Avtalion. That you did not properly serve, minister, the two giants of the generation, Shemaya and Avtalion. That is why you have forgotten this law of Passover, because of your laziness. That is why you need me, Hillel, to save you. In other words, you guys care so much about transmission, yet you did not trouble yourself to learn one of the basic laws of Passover when your teachers and your transmitters were still alive. And you need me, with my brilliance, to save you. Now, this, of course, is not the Hillel that we know and love. He is not the one who is known in Talmudic text as Anvitan Hillel, Hillel the humble, or Hillel the Ohev Shalom Varodev Shalom. Hillel, the lover of peace and the pursuer of peace. So when did this transformation take place? How did the Hillel that we meet in this story at this point become who he ultimately became? We are about to find out. As he stands there on Friday the 13th, explicating the laws of Passover and excoriating Israelites for their laziness, another question emerges that requires clarification. One of the laws of Passover is that while even when the sacrifice overrides the Shabbat, nevertheless, any action on behalf of the offering that could have been done before Shabbat must be done before Shabbat. Thus, the act of carrying the knife to the temple to perform the slaughtering on the 14th had to have been done the day before, on the 13th. An inquiry arises, what if we forget? What if we do not remember to bring our knives with us? What should we do? What do? This question comes up right in the middle of Hillel's drashot, right in the middle of Hillel's lecture about Pesach, and right in the middle of his lording over them the fact that he knows everything about Pesach, and they know nothing. Amrulo, they said to him, Rebbe, my teacher, Shachach v'lo hivi sakin me'erev Shabbat mahu. If somebody forgot to bring a knife from the day before, what should you do? Amar lahen, he responds, Halachazo shamati v'shachachti. I heard this question answered, but I have forgotten what my teachers told me. This moment is, of course, redolent with literary irony. It is Talmudic turnabout. He who was just criticizing all those gathered in Jerusalem for not having retained what they were taught, now he himself has to admit that while he once knew the answer to a basic question, he has now failed to retain it. At this point, Hillel, openly in front of all of Israel, after excoriating Israel for its ignorance, now has to admit, I do not know. Shmaya and Avtalion have taught me the answer to this question, but I do not recall what they said. Having no memory of the answer, the man who just several moments before was proudly praising himself, he now, strikingly and humbly, decides to trust the people. And he responds, Hanach lahen li Yisrael, im ein nevi'im hein, b'nei nevi'im hein. Let us leave it to the Jewish people. If they are not prophets, then they are the sons of prophets, meaning that they'll do the right thing on their own. He's saying, I don't know what the right answer is. Perhaps the people themselves know what to do. And the next day we are told, on Shabbat, that was the 14th of Nisan, Mi shepischo tle tochvo betzimro, Mi shepischo gdi tochvo bein karnav. One who was bringing a lamb for the Paschal offering stuck the knife in the wool so that the animal was carrying the knife instead of him. And one whose Paschal offering was a goat, which does not have wool, had the knife stuck between the horns. So again, the goat was carrying the knife and not him. Now this answer is not only not obvious, it's itself problematic, because anything halachically that you are not allowed to do on Shabbat, your animal is not allowed to do either. So actually the commentators are somewhat at a loss, or at least embrace the difficulty of why this is a proper halachic response. But that makes the fact that Hillel is willing to trust the people here all the more extraordinary. The man who invoked his brilliance and proudly proclaimed the people's ignorance only moments before is willing to learn from and trust the traditions of the people of Israel. And indeed, we are told in the conclusion of the story that Hillel saw this incident and remembered the halacha that he had once learned. And he said, yes, kach mekublani mipi Shmaya v'Avtalion. This indeed is what Shmaya and Avtalion once taught me. Thus the story concludes. From this moment on, Hillel is still the Nasi. He's made it. He is the patriarch. But he is also chastened. He has not backtracked from his usage of creative interpretation, but he has recognized the need to balance that with a reliance on the traditions of the people. Both notions, creativity, exegesis, insight, individual insight into the text, but also tradition. Both notions are at the heart of Jewish law. As Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik noted in his famous essay, Rupture and Reconstruction, Jewish religiosity is, of course, proudly legalistic, and exegesis is its classic mode of expression. But, Dr. Soloveitchik adds, at the same time, because the halakha is a sweepingly comprehensive regula of daily life, covering not only prayer and divine service, but equally food, drink, dress, sexual relations between man and wife, the rhythms of work and patterns of rest, it constitutes a way of life. And a way of life is not learned, but rather absorbed. Its transmission is mimetic, imbibed from parents and friends, and patterned on conduct regularly observed in home and street, synagogue and school, end quote. Similarly, Hillel too combines individual interpretation, the art of the a fortiori, with a reliance on tradition and on transmission. The story of the Paschal Lamb and of Hillel's ascension to the Nasi'et represents this combination, which is the hallmark of Hillel's age. As Rabbi Bini Lau puts it, even as the Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmuds differ regarding some of the details of Hillel's ascension, nevertheless, he writes, quote, both Talmuds share the notion that Hillel introduces the practical application of the exegetical principles in the land of Israel, and that he is appointed patriarch over all the land's inhabitants. Hillel's appointment ushers in an exciting period of creativity in developing the oral law, alongside the preservation of ancient traditions. Together, these two ideals serve as Hillel's guiding light. He expounds based on the rules of logic and simultaneously apprentices under the two foremost scholars of that generation. Hillel, in other words, embodies both individual creativity and is informed by tradition. This is Rabbi Lau. I would not go as far as he. I would not say that Hillel introduces the exegetical principles, but there is no question, based on the Gemara, that he does seem to emphasize exegetical creativity and the joining of that creativity with tradition and transmission. In building then on this, I would suggest an additional point, and that is that, rightly understood, this balance that Hillel ends up striking is perfectly captured in his most famous maxim, Im ein ani li mi li, if I am not on my own, who will be for me? Uchshani li atzmi mani, and if I am only on my own, who am I? This statement is not about ethical responsibility, but it is perhaps about rabbinic epistemology. What can a rabbi or legal expert know, and how can he know it? In examining a halakha question and seeking the truth, the process is one of individual effort and insight joined with the guidance of tradition. Imena nili mili, if I do not honestly apply my own capacities, utilizing them to employ the 13 midot, the principles of interpretation. Who will do it for me? U'chashani li'atzmi mani. But if I do that on my own without reliance on tradition, what am I? The statement, perhaps, then, reflects the central story of his life, with one clause representing his Babylonian brilliance, im'ein ani li mi li, the other side, u'chashani li'atzmi mani, the humility that he learns in relying on the Jews of Eretz Yisrael. Even the final clause in Hillel's famous Mishnah can perhaps be understood in this vein. Im lo achshav ematai, if not now, when? Every leader must address the halakha questions that face him in his own time, utilizing his own abilities while drawing on the traditions from the people that are being led. Yiftach bidoro kishmuel bidoro, the sages say, which means each leader leads for his own time, drawing on Klal Yisrael as he finds it in that generation and applying his own abilities as well. Literarily, in the Talmudic tale, in this magnificent story that we have just studied, the Paschal Lamb, which represents the dialectic between Yachid and Sibur, individual and community, which Hillel insists must be brought by Moado in its time, this Paschal Lamb thus ends up embodying Hillel's statement in its entirety. Imeinani li mili, uchashani li atzmi mani, v'im lo achshav ematai. Hillel then inspires creativity in the Eretz Yisrael of his age. And if that is the case, then we can understand all that follows after him, which, as we discussed yesterday, is described in the first chapter of Avot. Recall, as we said, that the age of Hillel and Shammai, the last generation of Zugot, of the pairs, that is the generation in which, following which disagreements explode into two entirely different schools. And it may well be that Hillel himself, in inspiring exegetical creativity, in sparking interest in Drashot, and in bridging Babylonia and the land of Israel, actually helps bring these debates about. Two schools, both employing methods of interpretation, Shammai and Hillel, emerge and debate with one another, until, according to tradition, it is declared, both sides are the words of the living God, but the law is in accordance with the house of Hillel. And here an irony can be found, because the sages insist that when it came to raw intellectual firepower, when it came to brilliance, to the power of exegesis, the school of Shammai was superior to the school of Hillel. They were machadadei tfei. They were sharper. Hillel's house won, in the end, because his students and followers personified not only creativity, but also openness to others in their halachic epistemology, because they recognized not only imeinani mili, but also kishani la'atmi ma'ani. Thus the Talmud tells us, I quote a translation, why was the halacha determined in agreement with the rulings of the house of Hillel? Because they were kind and modest, and they studied their own rulings together with those of the house of Shammai, and were even humble enough to mention the teachings of Shammai before their own. This teaches you, say the sages, that whoever humbles himself, the Holy One, blessed be He, raises up. And he who exalts himself, the Holy One, blessed be He, humbles him. Greatness flees from those who seek it and pursues those who flee it. End quote. Thus, the ultimate irony is introduced. The man who becomes the Nasi, the patriarch, because of his individual brilliance, that man fathers a school that becomes normative through its recognition, as he recognized, that answers can also come from others. The story of Hillel and the lesson of his life, of balancing creative interpretation and tradition, mimetic reception and textual analysis, embodies in its own way the history of halakha, which is itself an ongoing balance of tradition and individual interpretation. Many have noted that the Sephardic halakha culture focuses to a great extent on what has been received from generations past, on precedent, whereas Ashkenazic halakha often emphasized the posek's, the decisor's, individual analysis of the Talmudic text, which was then followed by often audaciously creative decisions. These are, of course, generalizations, and not every Ashkenazi or Sephardi posek fits these classifications. But one contrast from the modern age suffices. The two most influential poskim of the 20th century, one Ashkenazi, one Sephardi, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Avadi Yosef. The latter, Rav Avadia, will examine a conundrum by citing every book and responsum ever written pertaining to the question, and then decide, seemingly based on precedent. Rav Moshe, in contrast, will cite the Talmud, several Rishonim, couple sources, and then sometimes will take audacious halakhic leaps or make fascinating inferences. Both approaches represent aspects of our tradition and of Hillel's halakhic process, And, as we said yesterday, the convergence of Ashkenaz and Sephardi in Israel may well produce new fascinating forms of halachic scholarship and methodology. Meanwhile, it is Hillel himself whose magnificence has been misunderstood by so many, whose maxims are cited by everyone, but often without true understanding of who he was and what he represented. It could well be said that when many Jews know about Hillel, the most famous man in Avot, could be said while these Jews stand on one foot. But it actually behooves us all to heed Hillel's words, the words that are often forgotten, which are Zil Gemor, go and learn, take the next step forward, learn the eternal life lessons of a man who emerged from obscurity on the eve of a temple Passover to impact halacha, Jewish law, in a way that reverberates throughout Jewish life until this day.